It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CenturTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hi there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, someone left the cake out in the rain. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And we'll never have that recipe again. All right, so today we wanted to talk about the fact that we have the proliferation of cameras all around us these days. There seems to always be a camera somewhere, whether it's in the hands of a person or on a street corner or in a corner store or on someone's face. They seem to be just about everywhere now, right?
Yeah.
This has gone from science fiction to reality in our lifetimes.
Yeah. Like yeah.
Right. Yeah. When, well, I mean, not that any of us were around in 1949 when 1984 came out, but.
You just blew my mind. Yeah. When Orwell published 1984, which came out in 1949, and that really did presage this era of surveillance where, in that case, a very totalitarian and oppressive government was using surveillance to keep the population cowed and under control.
Right. There was a sense that you never knew when someone was watching you.
Right.
So there was always
you had to be on
fear.
Good behavior yeah. continually because, yeah, you had to operate under the assumption that you were being watched and that someone was going to punish you if you did anything wrong.
That's kind of interesting considering that when that book came out in 1949, that actually predates the deployment of a lot of CCTV technology, which followed a few years later. But the earliest I could find of any sort of use of closed-circuit television cameras dates back to 1942, and that was in World War II Germany.
Oh, wow.
They were using that not to keep an eye on citizens or try and report people or anything along those lines. They were using it because they needed a way to observe V-2 rocket launches without getting fried when something would go wrong. Mm. So losing a camera is better than losing a scientist with a clipboard who was standing there a second ago and now there's just a pair of smoking shoes.
Right. As we all know from Mythbusters.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it looks like CCTV cameras first became popular or widespread in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. There was some precedent for cameras in the UK before that, but it was all – it wasn't necessarily closed-circuit television cameras. But back in 1960, there were a couple of times when police in the UK installed cameras in Trafalgar Square. Once when the Thai royal family was visiting and they just wanted to make sure that they were able to keep an eye on crowd control. And then the other time was during the 5th of November, which, of course, is Guy Fawkes Day. Remember.
I remember. Mm-hmm.
Do you? The gunpowder treason and plot?
Wait, you're not saying they had a CCTV camera when he tried to blow up Parliament?
No, this was 1960 the anniversary of that. Actually, it was on the anniversary of him being captured. To be fair, Guy Fawkes Day is to celebrate the fact that the government captured Guy Fawkes, not the fact that a man tried to blow up Parliament.
Right.
You'd never know that from that movie and all the people who wear the mask.
Yeah, no, that's true. I did a full podcast about Guy Fawkes Day on a completely separate channel where I talked about what Guy Fawkes Day is all about and how the modern misconception, and particularly in America, casts it as sort of an anti-hero. But really, Guy Fawkes Day was all about
we stopped a treasonous act.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, but those were two incidents where the London police installed some cameras. Now, in both of those cases, those cameras were meant to just be temporary. They set them up in order to kind of give themselves a little extra manpower.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
Well, they thought it was such a great idea that they would just go ahead and deploy those suckers all over the place, although
what
it did take them
know?
A few decades.
I saw something about – I think So there were some cameras like up in Times Square in the 1970s and stuff like that. But this really got big in the 80s, I think. Between a figure I saw was that between 1980 and 2000, CCTV sales jumped 700%.
Yeah.
So that's when the explosion happened.
The early days were in the 60s and 70s where they were usually being laid out along roadways, things like that, in order to just keep an eye on how things were flowing through London, mainly. London was the big city where this was happening. You did have it in some other cities. New York had some in Times Square, like you mentioned. But and then you had some private companies or retail organizations that were installing them as a means to try and counteract any sort of shoplifting activity.
Mm-hmm.
So, but those were really the main uses until the 1980s. That's when it really started to, quote unquote, explode.
Well, actually, one misconception we might want to clear up is this idea that most of these CCTV cameras are public. The vast majority are still private.
Mm-hmm.
So when you've heard about how many times you might be photographed or video recorded going about your business throughout the day, most of those images are going to happen at, you know, the shop you go into, the place where you work.
The pub.
Exactly.
Yeah. There are plenty of official public cameras, public meaning that they're owned by the government as opposed to private companies. But they do it's just a fraction of all the cameras that are out there.
Right.
Although it should be noted that according to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1968, the police can legally use footage from private cameras to pursue any kind of – yeah.
Yeah, and they do all the time.
Of course.
Yeah.
So one interesting question that people started worrying about, especially in the in the post 9/11 era, when there started to be increasing awareness that maybe we should really worry about privacy and recording, people started to say, "How many cameras are there?
Yeah,
and how much of our lives are being recorded?"
Yeah, because there was no way of really knowing this.
I would argue there's still no way. Essentially, if you have a cell phone that was manufactured in the last 5 years, you probably have at least a still camera, if not a full digital video camera that can upload footage directly to the internet, or at least save it on the phone and then transfer it over.
Yeah, I'm just talking about CCTV. We'll get to personal devices in
Oh,
in
I
the
see.
Next
so you're,
podcast.
So even answering the question about CCTV is difficult.
That's all I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
People who have cameras and they're rolling. You can count on it. So there are a few different numbers. One number that you might have seen bouncing around a lot is an estimate that comes from the UK. And the UK is famous for this because it's often said that it's the most surveilled place in the world, right?
Yeah.
They've got cameras everywhere.
1984, by the way, set In London.
In Oceania, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Airstrip 1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the figure is 4.2 million. Now, I'll revise this in a second, but this has been, for years, people have bandied this about. 4.2 million cameras in the UK, and that works out to one camera for every 14 people.
Gotcha.
Yikes. I mean, and so you see this cited a lot of times by privacy advocates in the UK and stuff. But it turns out that this is probably not the most accurate estimate. Mm. In fact, it's probably very high because the way they got this estimate is that there was a paper that basically they looked at a couple of streets and they were like, well, how many cameras are on these streets combining public cameras and cameras in, you know, privately owned businesses and all that.
And then
they extrapolated that out and got this really high number. So in the County Cheshire mm-hmm. in England, mm-hmm. They had police community support officers go through and physically count all of the cameras to see, well, exactly how many are there really?
Mm-hmm.
And then they used some statistical models to say, well, you know, compared to the urban density and stuff in other areas – we can say that the UK more likely has 1.85 million cameras, about.
Significantly fewer than 4.2.
Well, less than half of the original yeah. estimate.
But still a bunch.
Yeah, well, there are a few funny things here. Either way, that's a huge amount of cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it's just kind of creepy that people have no idea. Their estimates are differing by the millions.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, When you get to big numbers, people are really bad about estimating that anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
This goes beyond just cameras. This goes to just how humans work in general. Mm-hmm. Like once we get beyond a certain point, estimations no longer really work out in our favor. We're really bad with big numbers.
Yeah.
It's also why you get things like, hey, let's play the lottery. Look how much money it is. What are the odds of winning? And you just, you know, the odds are so astronomical that you would...
Your eyes glaze over.
Yeah.
You're just like, well, that's big.
You're like...
Sure, whatever.
But someone yeah. has to win, mm-hmm. right? And so, but if you really think about the odds, you just think, well, really buying a lottery ticket and throwing a dollar away, there's not a whole lot of difference there. Yeah, you have a chance of winning, but it's so tiny.
And you're probably supporting your local schools, but...
Well, supporting some school. If my money goes to Georgia Tech, you're going to know I'm going to be upset. But at any rate, the point is that we're really bad at that sort of thing. So it doesn't really surprise me, you know, to go 1.8 million versus 4.2 million, because once you get over a certain number, that you might as well just say lots. There are
yeah,
lots
sure.
of cameras.
Well, the point is, either way, it's one of the most surveilled places in the world, if not the most, and it's incredibly dense surveillance.
Oh yeah, and this plays a role in television and movies and
absolutely,
you know,
and,
like
you know, like Torchwood and
Sherlock.
Sherlock,
like,
right?
There's the moment where Watson is called. He's answering the phone in a phone booth, which apparently they still exist, I guess. But he's answering a phone, and then the voice on the other line tells him to look up at the various corners, and he can see that there are the cameras that are mounted on the outside of buildings, and the cameras very specifically look away from his phone booth, for showing that the conversation is going to be private and not displayed on any kind of closed circuit television technology. So it's a part of life over there. In the United mm-hmm. States, it's still something that we would consider very unusual.
Right. I would actually argue, though, going back to a slightly earlier point, that it doesn't matter technically how many there are there due to principles that were talked about by Jeremy Bentham in the 1780s about the panopticon, which was the concept of this prison that had this a circular tower in the center, kind of a ring of a prison with a circular tower where
the cells are on the outside.
The cells are on yeah. the outside and the guards are on the inside, and the prisoners don't know when they're being watched, so they have to operate under the assumption that they're always being watched, like we were talking about in 1984 earlier. And this concept got a big reprise in the 1970s when Foucault was starting to talk about it as a metaphor for the way that all of these cameras around us and the watchfulness of society was mm. operating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, part of that comes into will come in when we want to say, what is the effect these cameras have? And we can get to that in a minute. Another thing I wanted to bring up, though, about this more recent count of the cameras in the UK is earlier when we were saying that most of the cameras are private, this was definitely the case here. You know, they counted in County Cheshire more than 12,000 cameras, and only about 500 of them were public.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So most of these, like we were saying, they're in parking lots, you know, shops, places that are privately owned.
People trying to protect their stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But they're recording you either way.
So that's still something that, again, is fairly alien to people in the United States. We don't have as many cameras. Now, the retail shops definitely do, but not as many cameras that are just mounted on the side of buildings as you would see in London, right?
We don't have as many, but some places in the United States are getting there.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of big cities in the United States now have a pretty serious CCTV infrastructure. For example, they think that probably Chicago is the most surveilled city in America. And an often cited figure is that there are 10,000 CCTV cameras in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if that is confirmed. That number shows up a lot.
I'm sure most of them are pointed at cemeteries to make sure the dead stop rising from the grave to vote in every election.
Well, that's possible.
No,
I was being too generous. I don't think that's what they're doing.
That's a corruption in Chicago joke.
Yeah, it is.
Here in Atlanta, supposedly, the city, over the course of a year, grew from 17 police cameras to more than 1,400.
That's a pretty explosive growth.
Yeah, and one of the big questions is, are we getting our money's worth?
You're right. Are these
Not
cameras
just here in Atlanta?
Cameras actually correlated with preventing crime?
Yeah, and turns out the answer is by no means unanimous, and it's really hard to get the statistics to agree on this.
Right.
Some studies seem to show that it does help a lot. Some studies show very little help. Some show almost no help at all.
Well, it's definitely a very complicated thing. I mean, I guess the only way you could say it wouldn't be complicated is if you were to look at crime rates in a neighborhood before there were ever any cameras there versus crime rates there once the cameras are put in there, and ignoring the fact of things like population changes. And
right,
all that
assuming
kind of stuff.
That nothing else has changed,
yeah,
which of course it's not.
Well, life is complex.
Sure.
You can do that. I mean, you can compare neighborhood statistics, but a lot of times what it seems like often happens is that when you implement these cameras, they seem to coincide with other new policies. Like, we also added more patrol cars.
You can't be absolutely certain that it was the cameras that had any sort of measurable impact. It may be one of these other initiatives that are enacted at around the same time.
Yeah, like, for example, one thing I saw was that when they added a whole bunch of CCTV cameras to the trains in Chicago, they said crime jumped 21%. Now, that doesn't mean there were more murders. They actually saw a decrease in violent crime, but there was an increase in recorded fare skipping or fare evasion and other stuff like that.
So really it just meant that the police were able to observe
that
a lot more
catching.
Well, I don't
on.
Know if that was the reason, but that could be it.
I'm not saying it's the reason. I'm saying that they were able to observe a lot more. Like, it may not have been that there was a rise in incidents. It was just there was a rise in awareness.
I see what you're saying. I don't know that that's the case, but that could be. One often cited, statistic by privacy advocates in the UK is that there's really only been about one UK crime solved for every 1,000 cameras.
Wow. Hmm.
Whether we give that credence or not. There's clearly a discrepancy about the value these things have. The people who seem most in favor of them are law enforcement, like officers themselves. And some of the discrepancy comes in the question of whether these actually prevent crime or whether they just make it easier to prosecute crime once it's been committed.
Gotcha. So it may be that it's not so much a deterrent as it is just an effective means of if you need evidence for prosecution.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. One thing I saw is that in one environment they seemed to suggest that putting cameras out along with signs that say, you know, there's a camera recording what you're doing right now, actually was more preventative than just having the cameras, you might guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, which is why the usually when they put these cameras out, they're you know, in this whole kit and caboodle of a giant box with these, you know, very big, very obvious sorts of things. Because yeah, they do more good by telling you that it's there than
right.
Hypothetically,
and you could even have a camera, like an inactive camera, sitting on the side of a building, and if you have a sign there, then it may have it may be a deterrent. But even if it's not active,
well, that actually may be the case in a lot, like there is clearly a lot of public skepticism about whether anybody's actually watching these cameras, and it's not entirely unfounded, because as much as it costs to install a camera, it costs that much more to pay somebody to pay attention to it in
sure.
real time.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. I was looking at cameras used in traffic situations, traffic monitoring, red light cameras, stuff like that. And,
mm-hmm.
There were similar discrepancies in the statistics that people found about whether they were useful or not. One study found that there was a significant increase in crashes, and especially crashes with injuries in Florida with red light cameras, possibly because people were slamming on their brakes in order to avoid getting a ticket at a red light rather than just going through it when perhaps it would have been more
safe to
do so.
Right. When the light is amber and it is no longer safe for you to actually stop, rather it's safer for you to go through, then that's what you're supposed to do. The problem is that a lot of people don't really seem to, at least in Atlanta, from my own, this is anecdotal, obviously, but from my own experience of riding around in cars in Atlanta, it seems that no one's really concerned about hitting on the brakes until the light is red. And even then, you probably got about two or three cars that go through first.
Oh, yeah. As my wife once said, in Atlanta, red light means, okay, only five more cars.
Right. Right. But we do have some intersections here in Atlanta that do have these cameras that are located on them that are supposed to take pictures of cars after they pass through a red light.
Oh, right. And these cameras are usually still cameras. They're usually tripped by sensors. They might be video or radar, or electromagnetic sensors that mm-hmm. are done through wires that are placed in the asphalt. And these cameras are in addition to other kinds of traffic cameras, speed cameras, cameras that are involved in police cars themselves that scan license plates, cameras that are starting to be installed on officers themselves. There's some of that gonna happen in Seattle. 582 American communities alone have some kind of traffic cameras in place. Several states prohibit the use of them. Several states have legislature going in right now in 2013, and it's a really contentious subject. Because,
sure.
Yeah, because again, you have a lot of people saying like, well, what? How much good do they do? How much privacy do we need? And you know, municipalities have some of these traffic cameras up online. The video ones, you can go check. There's entire databases of these things that you can access. And there are very real reasons why that's very helpful. You know, they could help first responders arrive on scene with an idea of what the situation is in case of a terrible accident. Or in case of a national emergency, or not even national emergency, in case of some kind of weather emergency or something like happened in Boston. You can let people know what's going on the ground.
It also means that someone who would normally be taking that route might be able to see that there's something serious going on and they know to reroute, which ultimately helps those first responders who are trying to get at the scene and take care of anyone who might be injured or whatever the situation is.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, you know, to an individual, it may seem like, oh, well, this way my commute's not going to be 3 hours long. But if you step out of that and you look at the big scheme of things, it also means that the people who are there to help in an emergency can actually do their job.
Yeah, of course this would tie into, as we've talked about before, the idea of a smart traffic grid. I mean, if
sure.
you're going to have such a thing in the future, like autonomous cars responding and doing traffic the smart way, you'd essentially have to have traffic cameras or something
right,
like
right,
that.
Right, yeah, and computers could be watching them and help you reroute to make sure that you get there as fast as possible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
here's a question, though.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder that maybe one difference between the idea of, say, cameras in a shop or on a street corner, looking at the sidewalk or a park versus traffic cameras at red lights. When do you have the expectation of privacy? And when should you be able to feel like, I shouldn't have to expect somebody's watching me?
Well, according to Katz versus the United States, as of 1967, people in public areas cannot expect privacy since they are knowingly exposing themselves.
The same thing is true in the United Kingdom, where if you are in any sort of public area, then you, by law, have no expectation of privacy as far as, you know, being caught on camera or anything along those lines.
As of 2010, the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said that just recording people in a public place is totally fine. It's recording with an intent to commit some further crime that is a criminal behavior.
So, oh, I see.
So yeah. if you're just, you know, out and about and you've got a camera going in a public place and it's just because you think it's a nice day and you want to record that, that's perfectly fine. That there may be people who take issue with that and they may make that known to you.
Yeah, this specific case was in private residences as well, private spaces. The case surrounded this woman who's I think a woman had passed away and without a will, and her son recorded a family conversation unbeknownst to the rest of the members of the family. And the court said that was totally fine and that he could in fact submit that video as evidence.
Interesting. Yeah, that's something, one of those things where you never know if it were to go further, if that would hold up or not. It's, that's of course the way law works in the United States, right? You challenge the law, or someone can challenge a law, and then it goes up the court system until, ultimately the Supreme Court could make a decision. Sometimes they decide not to decide, and then that sort of answers the question, at least in that particular case. There are other, incidents of cameras that I wanted to talk about. Joe, what?
Well, I thought there was one funny thing I read when looking at CCTV cameras in the UK. In conjunction with the traffic cameras, they've actually even got mobile CCTV cameras, meaning they've got surveillance cars.
Wow.
Huh.
These are like mobile units that drive around and record what's going on in traffic.
That kind of ties into what I was going to talk about, which are the dash cams that you find in Russia.
Didn't I set that up nicely?
You did. The more we talk about it, the less subtle it is. But that smooth segue allows me to talk about Russian dash cams. And of course, a lot of people who are on the internet, they're familiar with this because the videos from these have popped up all over the place. YouTube's got entire channels devoted to Russian dash cam footage.
Well, tell us all about it for those of us who lag behind.
So, it's what it sounds like. It's a camera that a driver would mount to their car in such a way as to record what's going on, like the forward view of what that they would see when they're behind the wheel. Often it's not mounted directly on the dashboard. It's actually the ones I saw were more frequently mounted on the mirror, the rear view mirror, mm-hmm. and would hang either next to it or underneath that and be up against the windshield. But the idea is that in Russia, there's a deep distrust in government and in the police, and there's a very deep belief that corruption completely permeates those institutions. And so there are a lot of Russian drivers. In fact, Al Jazeera in November 2012 said that it estimated there were about 1 million people in Russia have installed these dashboard cams. And the whole point is so that they can have a record of anything that happens while they are operating their vehicle so that they can use that in any case that would go to court that they would be involved in. For example, if you're driving down a highway in Russia and an official government car cuts you off or bumps into you, you would want to have footage of that so that if you were brought to court by this official, you could say, I'm not guilty of this. This car ran into me. And in fact, I've seen footage of that kind of instance. But they've also used it for other reasons too, because it's not just the government that tends to get up to little shady stuff in Russia. There are people who will attempt to fake getting hit by a car so that they can then sue someone and try and
collect insurance.
Essentially, they're trying to extort you for money.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even to get to the point where they're trying to get insurance. They're just trying to extort money from you. There's a video that I plan on linking to on the Forward Thinking Facebook and Twitter feed, so you be on the lookout for it. There's a video of this car where there's a man standing in the road. The guy driving the car comes to a complete stop, and he's stopped in front of the guy who's just standing there. The guy who's standing there looks at the car, then slowly leans over and essentially lays on the hood of the car for a second, then slowly lowers himself to the ground, and then limps off claiming that he was hit by the car. It was, I mean, it's so obviously wow. not a guy getting hit by a car. It is, I mean, it's comical. It's so badly done. And the fact that the guy caught the whole thing on camera shows that he could, you know, dispute this entirely, saying, I didn't, if anything, I can sue this guy for running into my car because my car was at a complete stop when he laid on my car.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is clearly a good idea, even in a place where if you totally trust the government and don't fear corruption at all, it would just help settle private traffic disputes. You know, you get into a wreck with somebody else and it's you're both saying, I wasn't at fault. Well, if you have it on tape.
Yeah, it's easier to say, well, you know, then according to this footage, you know, this car or this party was at fault. And that is used quite a bit in Russia. They also use it because there are often very treacherous driving conditions in Russia in parts where, in the winter where the roads get really icy. They need to be able to, if there's an accident, show what exactly happened so that way, you know, when it comes to insurance, you can claim the right thing. Also, they use it because insurance companies can sometimes withhold payments and say that, oh, no, that didn't happen the way you said it. And when you have a record of it, then you can say, no, you owe me money because based upon my policy, this is all covered. That's also to capture events on like road rage, things like that. Drunk driving accidents. I mean, it's pretty dark stuff. Now that there are some great dash cam videos that are out there that capture really wonderful little sweet moments. I'm not, you know, so it's nice that we can see some stuff out there that's not just the nastiest part of humanity, right? There are a lot of videos. I saw one that was just a montage of them, and I'd say about half of all the videos were cars that would stop in the middle of the road, turn on the emergency blinker so the driver could get out and help an elderly person cross the street.
Aww.
Because they couldn't move.
Because
the traffic was so strong and they would get out and put themselves at risk to help someone get across the street and then they'd get back in their car and drive off. So there, about half the videos were of that. So, and then there's some once in a lifetime events that we would not have seen if it weren't for the fact that there were Russian dash cams capturing it.
Are you talking about something falling out of the sky?
I'm talking about the Chelyabinsk meteor. Is that what you're talking about?
I think so.
Yeah. So this was a meteor that it was spectacular. The videos of this meteor that
people thought the videos were fake.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, it looked like a science fiction film. So.
Yeah. Yeah. This fireball flying over Russia. And there were videos taken not just from dash cams, but also from mobile devices as well. But the meteor flew over Russia and exploded over the Chelyabinsk Oblast, which caused a massive shockwave that spread out so far that buildings in 6 different surrounding cities suffered damage. 7,200 buildings in total were damaged by that shockwave. Mostly it was stuff like windows shattering because the shockwave was so powerful. But we would not have seen nearly as much footage of that if it weren't for the fact that these dash cams exist and that people upload the video footage to YouTube.
I foresee that things like this will become popular in places other than Russia. I mean, it's such a good idea. I can't imagine why you wouldn't want to end up doing that.
In the United States, you occasionally encounter some law enforcement officials who are not so keen on the idea of video cameras being turned on them.
Yeah, that's
true. That's a very general way of saying that there's a great deal of resistance in some communities among some law enforcement officials from the thought of citizens being able to shoot video of anything that's going on that involves police.
Oh, those that Seattle project that I had mentioned a minute ago, this is going to equip at least a dozen officers with a wearable camera for a year-long trial. And the reason is that the Seattle Police Department has gotten complaints of brutality recently and of other wrongdoings. And they decided as a protective measure to put these cameras on their officers and send them out into the world so that they could say, no, really, I was doing my job. This is the job that I was doing. And hopefully, if, you know, should anything terrible happen, it'll work the other way as well. But
Right. So I agree. I think that the dash cam is a good idea in the sense that it'll cut down on a lot of the shenanigans that happen, or at least will allow a wronged party the chance to prove that they, in fact, were the wronged party. It may not prevent those incidents, but if it helps a person get insurance or prove that they were not at fault in a particular situation, I think that's a great thing. I think that it's going to, you know, in America, I think it's tricky. We've got this sense that we have, it's this individuality, independence, privacy thing that's all wrapped up together in the sense of what it is to be American. And the idea of having cameras all around tends to make at least a certain segment of the population uneasy.
Yeah, well, they may have a point, because I can only imagine that this is going to increase. I mean,
yeah.
I don't see anything that's telling me, well, within 5 years we'll have fewer cameras. We're
right.
going to back off. I mean, this is going to increase in every direction from everything I can tell. Both more people are going to be having, recording ready personal devices, but we're all these cities are adding more CCTV cameras. I was reading about the CCTV industry is preparing for a big boom in the wake of the Boston bombings. Because,
sure, since they were so instrumental in helping catch the
right. Well, both were in the Boston Marathon bombings. Both public CCTV cameras and private recording devices were huge in catching the guys who did it. Like you saw within just a few days, those images came out, and I remember thinking at the time, like, wow. I mean, there's just so much being recorded that, like, we randomly got images of these guys. Nobody was trying to record them.
Right. These huge sweeping crowd shots and we were like, oh, no, that dude. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, not only are we going to see a lot more cameras deployed, and I agree with you, Joe, that trend is not going to slow down. It's, if anything, it's going to increase quite a bit. But we also have the technology now, the facial recognition technology. These are algorithms, software algorithms that are built, sometimes firmware algorithms that are built directly into cameras.
Mm-hmm.
More frequently, it's built into the back end, but it can be in either case. It can be in the device itself, or it can be in whatever is processing the video feed. That can go in and start to identify individuals. Now, you have to create a database for that to work. Obviously, you can't just point a camera that's at someone's face and then the camera somehow knows who that person is. But you could develop a database of people. And the way the camera does this, it essentially divides your face into quadrants. And it starts to look for points of similarity between your face and whatever faces are in the database. And if it matches a certain percentage of certainty, it'll go ahead and at least suggest an identity, if not just go ahead and assign an identity to that face.
So like a visual fingerprint, something that you don't have to have touched anything. You could have been wearing your fancy robber gloves and still get caught.
Right, because it's mostly looking at things like the distance of your eyes from other parts of your face, or how your chin is shaped, that kind of stuff. And it's designed to be able to extrapolate that information based upon whichever direction your face is facing. So even if you're not looking head on into the camera, a good facial recognition algorithm can at least come up with suggestions of who that person might be, assuming that, again, that the person is in the database. We see this all the time on social media sites like Facebook and Google+.
Yeah.
They have that face tagging technology in there to the point where it'll start suggesting people. Like you want to tag a picture, and often the very first name that pops up is the person that you wanted to tag, because it's comparing that face against all the other tags that you have made that appear in your friends list, and then starts to extrapolate from that. And, you know, if it's not that person, you just type in whoever it is, and then that gets added to the database.
Sure. Well, you can opt out of this
sure.
on Facebook and Google Plus for now,
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah.
And tell it not to create that algorithm, that specific number for you that says, you know,
this is how my face looks.
This is your face map. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when I see these technologies, I wonder exactly how good are they? I mean, can they tell the difference between Mick Jagger and Don Knotts? I don't know if you ever noticed how similar they look.
Whenever
when you really
they,
zero
whenever
in
they were
on the face,
but, prancing on stage, they were almost identical.
Or can they tell the difference between Natalie Portman and Keira Knightley? Right?
Yeah, I can't. I don't. Which one?
Y'all
was
have
it?
Seen these.
Which
phenomena,
one was in?
Right?
Which one was in Pirates of the Caribbean?
Keira.
I don't know. Okay, but those are the two that look really similar, right? I didn't make that up.
Maybe to you.
They're both a little bit elfin. It's like, sure, yeah.
No, but Don Knotts and Mick Jagger, definitely.
Yeah,
right?
You know, okay. Separated birth. But, you know, there.
You don't believe me. Go look this up after the podcast.
There are a lot of instances of people who look similar, but the thing about the computer algorithm is it can get really, really specific. Like looking at the position of your ears on your head and your, you know, things that are going to remain the same unless you've had some sort of, you could have plastic surgery that alters the way you look and that would mess up the algorithm, or at least the algorithm possibly wouldn't recognize you based upon whatever you had done. And when it comes down to things like, you know, identical twins, can it tell one twin apart from the other? Probably not. I mean, unless there are enough subtle differences for the computer to be able to pick up on it, keeping in mind the resolution on these cameras isn't always that incredibly sharp. You know, facial recognition software is getting better and better, but you still need a high-resolution camera to really take advantage of it.
Well, the resolution on the cameras plays a role even if you're not using facial recognition
software.
Sure,
if you're just looking at it.
Lots of the cameras that are deployed right now are not HD cameras, and they might play some sort of deterrent role, but the problem is once you get your hands on the footage, a lot of times it's like, well, it's a guy with a hat on. And,
which, again, is one of those things, like, if you've got someone who's watching the footage live, then they can respond to it in real time, which, you know, that's one deterrent. But if you're talking about using it as a means to pursue someone legally, then obviously the resolution, it plays a huge role.
Yeah.
And not only that, but the camera angle and the duration
yeah,
and all
yeah.
that kind of
because
stuff as
we
well.
Because we can't zoom in and turn it around the way that they can on police procedurals occasionally.
Right, right. No, yeah. Zoom and enhance,
oh, yeah.
Zoom and enhance does not work.
The old Blade Runner scene.
Yeah, well, the old every procedural ever since like 1992. But anyway, the big fear, I think, that folks who are really concerned with this trend, the big fear they have is that we're going to have this huge number of cameras out there, even more than we already do. And it's going to be a combination of the ones that are mounted on the sides of buildings, the ones that are inside businesses, the ones that are on dashboards, the ones that cops are wearing, and all the ones that we have at our disposal, the phones and the Google Glass and all the other kind of stuff.
And in traffic.
And in traffic. And all of these cameras could be streaming or uploading video to some sort of internet server. We're looking ahead in the future here. This is the dark version, right? So you've got all this video going into a server. It's more video than any person could ever watch because you're getting so many different streams all in real time. Obviously, no one could keep an eye on all of this. But if you designed really, really powerful algorithms that could identify people, and not only that, but also get triggered for certain instances, things that when this sort of situation happens, log it.
Or when this person shows up, log it.
Right.
Or, then, you know, if they're a registered sex offender, for example.
Yeah. So then you've got this global, always on eye that's watching everything and logging anything of note. And who decides what is of note versus what isn't? That's a big question. That's the big fear. And the thing is that the technology that we've got is heading in such a direction that sort of future is possible. Not necessarily that it's going to happen, but that assuming that we are able to keep up with the trends that we have now, assuming we're able to continue improving the algorithms and the equipment and deployment and somehow have the capacity to handle this much data, that's a big question.
Well, I mean, it seems to me, and feel free to disagree, the question is not whether we can do it. It's just whether we're going to.
Exactly. That's where the real question comes in. The technology is going to be
essentially can be done.
Yeah.
Right.
It is happening right now.
The nice thing is that being aware of that means that you can be part of the conversation and talk about what are the benefits, what are the things that are detrimental to society in general and your peace of mind in particular. Those are important conversations.
Yeah, it's interesting because when the idea of surveillance comes up, I feel this tug from both sides. I don't want to be paranoid, but I don't want to be naive. And I don't know how to feel about things like this. On one hand, I'm like, I mean, come on. I mean, the government is not actually like trying to track me and stuff like that.
They're bigger fish to fry.
Yeah. Like, why are they trying to see me undress or something? Like, who cares? Why would they? I just don't see that happening. But on the other hand, and again, you know, I don't want to be a sucker. Like,
sure.
We should be cautious. And there are probably some people who might have really legitimate fears, like,
Well, like activists, if you're protesting something and your government doesn't really appreciate you doing that, and you might, that protest is important.
Yeah.
So.
Right, sure.
Well, a lot of it depends on the orientation of the government, right? Like, I mean, are you scared of this government now? Well, I mean, the same infrastructure will be there with whatever government exists in 40 years.
Sure.
Is that government something we shouldn't worry about?
Of course. And there are suits in progress that are discussing this kind of data and this kind of information. The ACLU, as of May 10th, 2013, got involved in a lawsuit in California about those automatic license plate recognition scanners that are in some police cruisers that can scan, you know, hundreds of license plates per minute going at pretty high speeds through a parking lot. And there was concern that some of the data was being kept for too long or that it could hypothetically be used to create these records of what normal citizens with no records of wrongdoing are doing and where they're going.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, and, you know, I think it's important for us just to remember that while we're painting this sort of Orwellian future that's very frightening, obviously it's not a foregone conclusion that that's going to be what the future is. And that if we do pay very close attention and we're careful, we can have all the benefits of this technology without the, you know, the scary, dark science fiction dystopia version as well.
Right. Lots of people don't like to mention the benefits because, I don't know, I mean, there's a cynical tendency we have to play up the
but
paranoia.
But what if it is terrible?
But, yeah. You know, yeah. But, I mean, they do actually solve crimes. It's debatable to what extent, but, I mean, they helped, surveillance helped catch the Boston bombers.
Yep. So, I mean, clearly there are a lot of sides to this issue. It's very complex, and we don't mean to suggest that it's at all something you can boil down and solve in a simple podcast. But these are good questions to ask. It's good to think about as we move toward the future and make sure that we have the best possible positioning for everything from our rights of privacy to our personal safety and to make sure that we have those checks and balances in place. These are all things that we need to think about. So it's good to have this discussion. And guys, if you have any suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, please write in. Let us know. You can send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@discovery.com or go to fwthinking.com. That's our website where we have all the videos, the blogs, the podcasts. We've got links to our social media stuff there. So come visit us. Be part of the conversation. Tell us what you're excited about. Tell us what you want to know more about. We definitely want to hear from you. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.